I have prepared the lecture. There is a written text. I will present you some excerpts, and I leave the text to Cristiano. So, I am deeply moved to revisit the monastery of San Nicolò, where during the first 6 years of the European Master Program existence, I worked in a spirit of agony and ecstasy. Some might call that romantic. I'm not ashamed to accept the adjective. It was a totally new and original experience, given both its educational content and its organizational structure, an academic experience, an experience in transnational citizenship, an experience in supranational integration, an experience made fecund by the generous collaboration of illustrious colleagues from various European universities. So, Os Fischer and Florence Benoit-Romer were since the beginning in the European Master. And courageous staff from the European Commission, Daniela Napoli, already you, Cristiano, mentioned. Daniela Napoli in particular. Professor Marco Mascia is here. At the time, he was the assistant to the EMA director. Now he's my successor as the director of the Human Rights Center, the Padua University. And I want to mention the Tini staff, which included the highly virtuous trio, Elisabetta Noli, Corinna Greco, and Alberta Rocca, since the beginning. In collaboration with the sister universities and the European Commission, with considerable grace and in a spirit of service, the University of Padua acted as a legal incubator for the new experience. The goal within the context of university cooperation was to set up a European joint degree qualifiable as an authentic European integrated diploma, like the single currency, the euro, no? An integrated European diploma. That is also the formal substance of the of your degree. And we succeeded. Our enterprise was soon considered one of the most advanced, if not the most, I think the most advanced achievement in the Bologna process. My mind teems with memories, of course. I share four of them with you like a tale, a minor story, but meaningful, I think. So, in the first year, especially, we had problems in accommodating the Masterini. Together with Professor Mascia, we managed to get our hands on a little hotel behind St. Mark's Basilica, the Hotel Città di Milano, with the teeny double rooms. To each floor, we assigned the name of a paragraph from Boutros Ghali agenda, an agenda for peace. So, first floor, preventive diplomacy, ground floor, peacekeeping, the other, peace building and peacemaking. The scant level of material comfort was amply compensated by cultural identification with the agenda of the United Nations Secretary General. The training field missions in the field training mission, now you call them field trips, but at the beginning, the training field mission. In January 1998, started out in Bosnia and Herzegovina, two military aircrafts, the noisy C-130, transported us. And in that month, in January 1998, we were traveling from Sarajevo to Mostar, in two buses lent by the Spanish military contingency stationed in Mostar. Halfway through the journey, amidst snow-covered mountains, the larger bus occupied by most of the young master candidates, Professor Marsh and myself, caught fire. In 5 minutes, it was completely destroyed. The first generation of Masterini, together with the then IMA director and assistant director, were miraculously saved. Miraculously. The human route of the master program proved capable of triumphing over fire and frost. It symbolized vital fecundity. So, we are now the witness with the global campus. During the first field mission, our headquarters were at the University of Sarajevo in a near state of ruin. During the inaugural meeting chaired by the Sarajevo University rector, we gave voice to our dream of setting up a regional master program with headquarters in that very university. 3 years later, in January 2001, that dream came true. We were again in Bosnia and Herzegovina with the training mission again. Now for our third training mission, to witness the birth of the regional master for Southeast Europe. The rector of the Sarajevo University, in the presence of the vice-rector of the University of Beograd, a fact reflecting the political peacemaking process, it was moving, that participation, presided over a crowded assembly uniting master students from Venice and Sarajevo. That was an ideal beginning for your network now, as it stands today, a beginning under the auspices of human and academic solidarity. I need not emphasize the importance of networking in facilitating cooperation as an instrument of soft power. Not only dreams and theories, etc. Networking is an instrument of soft power. The IMA growth is marked not only by goodwill and commitment on the part of teachers and students, but also by spillover dynamics. We might say that the IMA spillover emerges in varying types. There is a typology. I constructed a typology of the IMA spillover. Logistic spillover. IMA originated in 1997 in the Palazzo Ducale in Venice, in a small ground floor room. Inauguration of the first academic year took place on the second floor in the so-called Sala del Piovego. The following year, we rose to the fabulous Sala del Gran Consiglio. Membership spillover. In 1997, we were 10 partner universities. The year after, 15. Today, we number 41 universities. Partner. Networking spillover. It emerges in the context of regional master programs. In the beginning, there was one. Today, there are six. Institutional spillover. At first, it was the University of Padua, which furnished the strict legal groundwork. Later, we came to set up the DIUC, the association of our universities endowed with legal, juridical personality. Something, it was very original some few years ago when we established the association with legal personality. Universities are very, very sovereign. It was not so easy to get all universities within a legal entity as an association. And we will see territorial spillover. I am finishing, concluding on the typology. From Giudecca, because the first year the classes were in the Giudecca island, from Giudecca to San Nicolò, from San Nicolò to include hopefully the monumental barracks Caserma Pepe. we hope, huh? From the monastery courtyard to the human rights village on the island of Lido, currently aided by, I learned, huh, by the Serenissimo Governor Fabrizio Marrella. So is the name I am assigned, Serenissimo Governor. So, I have some reflections to share with you. First reflections on the subject, the human-centric compass for world order. My reflection here is articulated in different parts. I will start with the human-centric compass for world order. As we all know, ever since 6 October 1997, at the end of the IMEI awarding inaugural ceremony, university rectors and professors together pronounced the solemn formula. Bearing in mind the principle of the international law of human rights and in the spirit of inter-university cooperation, we declare open the academic year of the European Master's Degree in Human Rights and Democratization. It's a holy formula, since the beginning is the same. A recital of this formula reflects the will to contribute toward the effectiveness of international human rights law and to facilitate the spillover dynamism within it. There is a dynamism within international law of human rights, a dynamism that is inherent to the universal norm, which, precisely because it is universal, is intrinsically fertile, fecund. As we know, international human rights law, jus positum, originated in the history of law with the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1945-1948. The Universal Declaration did not remain a solitary voice crying out in the desert, nor a sacred icon, mysteriously remote and static. Instead, it revealed itself as the fecund mother of the many legal instruments constituting the organic body of international human rights law, from the Universal Declaration to the Covenants, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. And you have the regional conventions, both universal and regional conventions are endowed with protocols, and so on, and so on, and so on. The fecundity of standard setting, whose demographic growth, some say, should be somewhat regulated, we had a lot of standard setting, has been accompanied by that of human rights machinery. So you know, we have now a very, very large machinery at the international and regional level. Human rights mainstreaming is, so the spillover, is at work in various fields, including the critical field, for instance, of bioethics. In this area, there are two very important instruments, the two universal declarations of UNESCO on the human genome and human rights, and on bioethics and human rights. It's very important to bear in mind those two legal instruments. And we might even speak of a force of attraction exercised by international human rights law towards other areas of international law or other chapters of international law, in particular international humanitarian law and international criminal law. Attraction with the logic proper to it, to the international law of human rights, summed up in the pair life peace. Here in my paper there are some explanations. How to overcome, another reflection, how to overcome liquidity of the current human condition. The Farseeing visionary fathers and mothers who in the mid of last century worked to create the new international law established several principles present in the DNA of a just and peaceful world order. In a wholly positive light, the international human rights law advanced and opened the era of globalization as we perceive it today. Human rights, in a positive mode, have advanced globalization. The legal global compass of human rights is actually available to guide the multiple diversified globalization processes that crucially affect us all. It is more and more necessary in responding to such great challenges as world governance. I heard, speaking here of world, of global governance, but I speak here of a world governance of the economy. Perhaps better, a world government of economy. In respect for the principles of the interdependence and indivisibility of all human rights, social and economic rights are suffering nowadays. Other implications, reform of the international monetary system, real disarmament, reform aiming to democratize and strengthen the United Nations, safeguarding the natural environment, and intercultural dialogue. The fact that this global compass exists and that it remains valid is reiterated in the recent declaration of the high-level meeting of the 67th session of the General Assembly. The subject is the rule of law at the national and international levels. Let me quote some few excerpts. For instance, we are determined to establish a just and lasting peace all over the world in accordance with the purposes and principles of the Charter. The Charter is still strongly valid, the UN Charter. Another quotation, we reaffirm that human rights, the rule of law, and democracy are interlinked and mutually reinforcing, and that they belong to the universal and indivisible core values and principles of the United Nations. We reaffirm, and so on and so on. Please read this very, very important declaration of last September of last year. According to the Universal Human Rights Code, the architecture of a just and peaceful world order can only be one of multi-level governance to be exercised according to the principle of subsidiarity, I heard, speaking of subsidiarity, and therefore in respect for cultural and institutional diversity. In order for such a structure to function, we need to share the global compass core values. The meaning of human rights. So, when we say human rights, we use a legal phrasing. But the substantive content, meaning of human rights, is vital needs of the human being, both material and spiritual. I think this is something that all over the world we can share, this concept. So, we need to share the global compass core values. The big question is, how can we develop the sharing of core values in a period marked by distrust in numerous political leaders' capacity for governance, by revolt against 4 decades of disasters caused by an orgy of neoliberalism, by more than 20 years of easy war, by the persistence of political-religious fundamentalism? Should we surrender to the pessimism of Zygmunt Bauman, who speaks of the current human condition in terms of liquidity? It is uncertainty. Should we surrender to that of Marshall McLuhan, who described the globalizing world as a quarrelsome little village devoid of safe homes where we can abide peacefully? No, certainly not. Personally, I believe that not everything is liquid. There is something solid in today's world. As I noted before, the right compass exists and is there to guide us. And homes do exist in which we can develop reciprocal knowledge and cooperate toward the common good. I refer to the many legitimate multilateral and supranational institutions at global and regional levels. These are the houses of cooperation. The future of human rights is rife with stumbling blocks along a pathway which, however, has reached a point of no return, a path leading the system of international relations once and for all outside the primitive state of bellum omnium omnibus, the war of all against all, towards an architecture, as I mentioned before, of multi-level democratic governance. We might view today's complex transition toward a more fair and peaceful world order by using four metaphors. Metaphors and signs of the times are analytical tools relating not only to our capacity, to our will to discern, but also to our willingness to marvel over the opportunities offered to the goodwill of persons. Such tools help to expand the horizons of hope through commitment to plan making and action. The first metaphor is that of childbirth. In our case, it regards labor pains. What must be born in terms of a new world order does not remain at the stage of mere wishful thinking. Rather, as I told before, it is already a project, indeed already a pathway which has been clearly traced in its essentials since 1945-1948. The issue is not to conceive a child, but to help the newborn baby grow and mature. A rather artistic metaphor, this is another, is that of the mosaic. For an image formed in mosaic to be recognizable, we need not only tessere pieces, but also their composition according to a design. As regards the world order, the tessere exists, but the mosaic cannot take shape unless we commit ourselves to compose them. I am thinking in a holistic perspective. All is global, all is globalizing. We have to be holistic. We have to control the situation. As mentioned before, the project for a humanly sustainable world order exists. What we need to do is make it visible, develop it. So, the third metaphor centers on a bucolic image. Through the centuries, universals are sown. That is, those inventions, creations, and discoveries in various fields and in various parts of the world which do and must benefit all members of the human community. They are global goods making up the material and non-material world heritage. All marks points of no return along the pathway of civilization promoting humanity. In the field of juridical creativity, international human rights law is a fully shaped universal. The fourth metaphor is that of a house. Again, one as vast as the planet Earth, richly furnished with sophisticated devices which, if properly used, would make the life of its inhabitants more comfortable. Certain of these household appliances function only intermittently or have stopped functioning at all once unplugged. Beyond metaphor, the world today has available new fine new juridical norms, sophisticated international institutions, innumerable instruments suitable for enhancing cooperation toward the common good in all areas. We must use them. We need the political them to make them work. We need to stop making the United Nations, for instance, the United Nations and other legitimate multilateral institutions, the scapegoat for political and juridical failures caused by states governing classes, the most powerful ones in particular. Some few concepts on intercultural dialogue, religious freedom, secularities, etc. Multiculturalization all over the world is one of the many processes relating to globalization. It is often addressed as a disturbing factor of social cohesion instead of considering it a physiologic, cultural, and economic enrichment for societies. The best answer to the question of how to move from a stage of suspicion and fear to one of acceptance and inclusion is intercultural dialogue. It's a very important tool. Sharing core values, this is the premise, sharing core values is the necessary premise for carrying out a fructuous intercultural dialogue. I mean sharing values and not deleting or ignoring values. Putting aside the solution of exporting and forcefully imposing values, see the dreadful results of the so-called humanitarian wars, we must choose the way of dialogue to seek an axiological common ground, values, an axiological common ground, and go on in a spirit of healthy secularism. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights provides the core values we are referring to. Values to be translated, this is the task of the intercultural, values to be translated into concrete shared goals in places which must become inclusive. And the human rights paradigm is also an instrumental function to play as a code of communication symbols. And we have to prize this legal compass. This is certainly to share a core of fundamental values. This is a prerequisite, but not enough to achieve the principal aim of the intercultural, that is, inclusion of all in the political community to benefit from equal citizenship rights. For to be fructuous, dialogue among individuals and groups bearing different cultures should occur among equals. If not, the case will be another kind of interaction, for instance, for deliberate homologations from one side or another. And the equals are the original holders of the universal citizenship. The right reply to the question, intercultural dialogue for what, is dialogue for working together to imagine and put into practice common project for common good goals. Sometimes intercultural dialogue is considered as an opportunity to compare identities. Okay, I can tell you my story, you can tell me your stories, etc., etc. Comparison, and we stay there. No. The cultural dialogue for doing together, where? In a city, in a place that should become, should be transformed into an inclusive place. So. Religious freedom, of course, is one portion, very huge portion of multiculturalism, and it should be the religious freedom should be addressed not only within the specializing context framework of interreligious dialogue, but also in the framework of intercultural dialogue. Religions are at the root of the great cultures. Religious leaders, they do not agree to be invited as part of the cultures. They are self-referential. At the top, at the summit, they have to become religious leader part of the intercultural dialogue. I think the benefit also of religious freedom. So in my paper, you have a lot of quotations, reference to the recent international instruments. Very interesting. I devoted one paragraph to religious freedom and education, always in the context, in the framework of intercultural dialogue. And I recommend among different international legal instruments, a recommendation prepared by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. It's a very, very, very advanced position, saying that also in the religious establishment, human rights should be taught. It's necessary that religious leaders, religious personnel, be educated and formed and trained to respect human rights and fundamental freedom. I am going to the last part of my speech. New language to develop a universal culture of human rights. We know that UNESCO is advocating for the construction of a universal culture of human rights. And intercultural dialogue should contribute to construct, to develop, to consolidate a universal culture of human rights. Dear Masterini and Masteroni, at the end of your study program, you received or will receive an official diploma as human rights defenders. You talk it a lot, huh? With a precise identity defined by what we consider our Magna Carta, no? The United Nations Declaration of 1998 on the right and responsibility of individuals, groups, and organs of society to protect and promote universally recognized human rights and fundamental freedoms. Let me quote Article 1 and Article 7. You know the declaration includes 20 articles, very all important. But I quote Article 1, everyone has the right, individually and in association with others, to promote and to strive for the protection and realization of human rights and fundamental freedoms at the national and international levels. Article 7, everyone has the right, individually and in association with others, to develop and discuss new human rights ideas and principles and to advocate their acceptance. L'imagination au pouvoir. Huh? These articles tell us that human rights, being universal, are without borders, that everyone is allowed to act in their defense inside and outside his or her own state, that everyone is called upon to nourish with new ideas the human rights culture, made up of law and politics, theory and practice, education, advocacy, commitment. Those who work for the cause of human rights, peace and solidarity are gaining possession of these precious legal instruments. We are now considering, by making it a transnational identity card for the pioneers of universal citizenship, marked by a strong action orientation in the global space. The examples below indicate a few ways in which we can use, allow me to frame my opinion. Now we can use Article 7 of the Declaration to exploit and translate into action what is inherent in universal law. Human rights law as living, law with potentialities longing to be identified and developed. So, the principle, for instance, how to use Article 7. The principle of the best interest of children, proclaimed by Article 3 of the International Convention on the Rights of Children, is normally evoked when referring to needs and issues which are specific to these two age groups, children and adolescents. While being useful in its specific context, that principle is also a candidate for membership among the general principles of international law. That is, it should be formally added to the list of principles included in the 1993 Declaration of Vienna. So, equality, universality, and so on, the best interest of children. So, we have to strive, we have to also theoretically build up this inclusion. Another example of such new ideas and principles regard the way of defining the international community. So, this is for our language. Forget some very, very abstract lawyer in this case. Traditionally, we refer to international community as an entity constituted solely by states and the multilateral agencies created by states. This conceptual category has been used and abused by the more powerful states. In practice, it has become an evanescent entity. In the language of human rights, instead, and in perfect alignment with reality as it is evolving, one should define international community as a much vaster, much more concrete institutional container, including human subjects, persons and peoples, as well as, of course, states and other institutional entities. The international community is marked by the ethics of inhabiting the earth as a home shared by all members of the human family. Who are the members of the international community? States? No, all the members of the human family. So I say something about, I wrote about human family. Another example, in times not too remote, I was taught at my university that the state is a political entity par excellence. Political since it is not predetermined in the choice of its objectives, unlike functional agencies such as international organizations created by states. In short, I was taught that the state as such may adopt all the goals it wishes. Clearly here we see an extreme apology for the sovereignty of a body superiorem non recognoscens. Now, in light of the international recognition of human rights which has occurred, such an idea is untenable. Since the human person is recognized as an original subject of fundamental rights, even by international law, the state cannot but be considered as a derived entity. And being derived, the state itself is functional. This makes not only the political agenda, but also the very public institutional form of governance as well, I mean statehood, teleologically predetermined, that is obliged to prioritize given goals. Telos, the end, the goal, the aim. Again, we must innovate our theoretical framing of citizenship using appropriate conceptual categories that allow us to grasp the sense of evolution and of the agonizing process of the redefinition occurring today of such an institution. Suffices to recall the contradiction pervading national immigration legislations. And we know that very well, yeah? Also in Italy. Before the advent of the international law of human rights, citizenship was essentially characterized as being national, unilateral, octroyé by the state and based on the jus sanguinis, the law of blood, more than on the jus soli, the law of land. In a perspective of distinction separation, in short, ad alios excludendos, to exclude the others. In virtue of the new international law, human rights law, a universal citizenship has emerged which asserts primacy over national citizenships. It is the citizenship of the human person as such, endowed with fundamental rights formally recognized by current international law as being inalienable. The metaphor of the tree helps us to grasp the meaning of this novelty. National citizenships, which the jure posito, according to law in modern history, are more ancient than universal citizenship, so the national, agraphic, bureaucratic citizenship, are like branches on a tree trunk. In order to produce leaves and fruit, the branches must be physiologically joined to the trunk and, by way of it, obviously, to the roots. The roots are the fundamental rights. Together with the trunk, they constitute the juridical status of the human person, internationally recognized as a human being, not as an anagraphic citizen of a given state. Thus composed, the tree would produce the institution of plural citizenship, plural citizen. In light of this novelty, which I repeat, is juridical and not merely poetic, not utopian, we need to accept the fact that with the entry of the international legal system into what we might call the human-centric, peace and life-based plenitude of law, the traditional parameters of jus sanguinis and also of jus soli must confront with the superior jus humanae dignitatis. Jus humanae dignitatis. I mean, by summarizing, jus humanae dignitatis must prevail on jus sanguinis. Jus sanguinis should be deleted. And this is a very important exercise also for our academic exchange to think about this new plural citizen where you have the universal citizens and the sub-universal citizenship, the national, subnational, regional, land citizenship, so on and so on. We could continue, but I am really finishing the discourse. Dear Masterini and Masteroni, you are the authentic witnesses to universal citizenship. Be aware of this. You carry human rights in your minds and your hearts. I'm sure, we are sure, we share this condition. You are experts, or you have to become experts in soft power, in using soft power, and expert also in architecturing global governance. I'm sure you will become capable of innovating in language and practices, being aware that you are the frontline servants of the human family, a crucial smart mass inside and outside the academic world, a powerful catalyzer of new leadership and of qualified civil, cultural, and political service within states and international organizations. And many, many wishes for your, we say in Latin, ad maiora. Always keeping in mind universal values. So with humility, but also with determination. We have to act in this globalized world that is not all liquid, not all deprived of institutions, and so on and so on. We must also exercise skills, political skills, diplomatic skills. What I am saying is what make the substance of soft power. So communication, skills, cooperation, patience, but clear idea, plan. So many wishes. Thank you for your attention.